Hi, and welcome to Lakeshore Update. I'm Dee Dodson. On this edition of the podcast, you'll hear the latest on the East Chicago City Council approving an ordinance that maintains COVID-19 public safety measures within the city limits. Brandon Smith reports Indiana U.S. Senators Todd Young and Mike Braun are asking the U.S. Supreme Court to overturn its longstanding precedent that legalized abortion nationwide. And Chris Nolte has a conversation with Indiana University Northwest economist Micah Pollack, who shares his insights on the economic effects of the pandemic. All of that and more on this edition of Lakeshore Update. The East Chicago City Council unanimously approved an ordinance that maintains COVID-19 public safety measures within the city limit, especially with the surge of the Delta variant. Council members adopted an ordinance in June 2020 requiring all persons who enter public places and government buildings within the city to wear face coverings to prevent the spread of the coronavirus. Health Department Director Diana Garcia Burns says the new ordinance is needed to supersede any further action by the governor and make masks a continued requirement in the city. Burns says she is very concerned about the surge of the variant and its potential impact on a community that's already hard hit by COVID-19.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dodson.
Like other cities in the region and elsewhere, the city of Gary is looking at ways to best leverage the federal funds it received from the American Rescue Plan. The Steel City is receiving a total of $80.3 million. City Council members held their first public information session this week to explain the rules it must follow in using the funds. The city received an initial receipt of the funds back in May. The second disbursement will arrive in May 2022. The city has 3 years to spend the funds. Councilwoman Tay Atkins told the Post Tribune that the city has to approve a plan accounting for it, periodic reporting, and a detailed accounting of how the money is spent is part of the federal requirement. Atkins says funds may be spent from four buckets and must show how the spending is in response to the negative impact of COVID-19. Funds must be used for public health and economic impacts to replace revenues lost due to COVID-19, to provide premium pay to eligible essential workers, and to invest in water, sewer, stormwater, and broadband infrastructure.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dodson.
The LaPorte County Council is going to rely on a part-time person to handle employee work-related complaints rather than hire someone full-time. The county commissioners felt the new position would create the time needed to look into workforce-related complaints more thoroughly, as well as to increase the hiring of minority candidates. But Council President Randy Novak says he feels both tasks can be accomplished without spending more than $40,000 on another full-time salary.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dodson.
An important educational and professional program is being offered at a regional high school. Lakeshore Public Radio's Sharon Jackson reports.
Maryville High School is going to run its own certified nursing assistant program this year. Bob Phelps, Director of Technology and CTE, told The Times the program is being made possible with the help of two instructors. It also serves the growing need for healthcare workers in the community. The high school has partnered with organizations in the past to provide qualified instructors and curriculum for the past 5 years. Moving the program to the high school reduces fees for CNA students and reduces transportation challenges that come with the students going off-site during the school day. There will be a classroom and lab for the CNA program. There will also be two registered nurses who each bring more than 10 years of experience working in various healthcare settings. They were hired as educators to accommodate the growing number of students in this year's program. For Lakeshore Public Radio, I'm Sharon Jackson.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
The COVID-19 Delta variant accounts for more than 80% of sampled positive cases in Indiana. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Lauren Chapman reports on the effects of the variant on hospitals in the state.
Dr. Robin Ledyard is the Chief Medical Officer for Community Health Network. She says hospitals are preparing for increases in severely ill COVID-19 patients as Delta continues to spread through the state. From July 3rd to August 3rd, the number of Hoosiers hospitalized for COVID-19 has more than doubled. But Ledyard says how the Delta variant has moved through other countries may help hospitals estimate the timing of Indiana's peak.
We should, you know, see that spike happen probably in September, mid-September. And then we may see some increase in hospitalizations continue.
Ledyard estimates Indiana would peak at about half the cases and hospitalizations it saw over the winter, based on how much of the state is currently vaccinated. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Lauren Chapman.
This story and the larger FAQ on our website comes from questions we received through our text group, the Indiana Two-Way. To join, text Indiana to 73224.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Most Hoosiers have another 2 months grace period from getting evicted. Indianapolis Corporation Counsel Matt Giffen says the extension of a federal ban on evictions buys some time to give renters more lasting help. Eric Berman reports.
It's the third extension of a year-long moratorium, which now expires October 3rd. Corporation Counsel Matt Giffen says it gives renters more time to apply for federally funded rental assistance. It also means more time to work out the kinks in a new city program to help renters in eviction suits.
We haven't seen the kind of tsunami of eviction we were worried about, knowing that there are a lot of people who are behind on their rent. It continues that rapid period, but it doesn't eliminate the overall problem.
The moratorium applies only if you've done your best to pay your rent, but the pandemic has dented your income. Eric Berman, Network Indiana.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Indiana U.S. Senators Todd Young and Mike Braun are asking the U.S. Supreme Court to overturn its longstanding precedent that legalized abortion nationwide. The Hoosier lawmakers joined the vast majority of their Republican colleagues in Congress on a brief in a case that threatens people's access to abortions. A Mississippi law bans abortions after 6 weeks. Such laws have been typically struck down, but the conservative Supreme Court's decision to take the case has led many to believe a full overturning of the landmark 1973 abortion rights case Roe v. Wade is possible. That's what Young and Braun want. And political scientist Andrew Down says, politically, that's a safe position.
They recognize this is going to really excite their base. I think they also recognize that it's really going to excite the progressive base, but they understand their base is bigger than the progressive base.
There's limited public polling on abortion in Indiana. But what polls there are suggest Hoosiers are split close to even on whether abortion should be illegal in all or most cases. Down says if the court allows states to ban abortions, Young and Braun will face tougher questions.
Logically, they'll both get pushed, well, when should abortion be available?
Hundreds of women died every year nationwide seeking illegal abortions before the Supreme Court's Roe decision.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
The Indiana Supreme Court on Tuesday denied Indiana Attorney General Todd Rokita's emergency petition to halt a trial court from continuing procedures in the governor's lawsuit against the legislature. In a single-page order, the justices denied the attorney general's request, but the court noted that Rokita's request for the permanent writ is still under advisement. The attorney general argued the Indiana Constitution prohibits any civil process against senators and representatives while the General Assembly is in session. He claims that is because the legislature recessed instead of adjourned in the spring so that members could reconvene in the fall to redraw the legislative and congressional district maps.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Indiana legislators are looking for ways for more out-of-state professional licenses to transfer easily into the state. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Justin Hicks reports, it comes as a variety of industries say they're having a hard time getting people to move to the state.
Experts from career fields, including mental health, social work, and medicine, testified at a legislative summer study session. They say Indiana's licensure process for out-of-state workers is slow and has antiquated requirements like mailing documents. Instead, they say it should be digital and offer quick verification methods. Senator Ron Alting shared the concern of several legislators that a frustrating licensure process could be adding to a shortage of skilled workers.
It's time to erase the chalkboard and get in the 21st century here and do some things that can streamline, get these people's licenses quicker.
Lawmakers say they'll consider future legislation that would enter into a compact or reciprocity agreements with other states to share information. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Justin Hicks.
Listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Students returning to class this month may be interacting with an unknown number of police officers in Indiana schools that haven't been specifically trained for the job. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jenny Lindsay spoke with education reporter Lee Gaines about why some Indiana school resource officers want lawmakers to pass legislation that would require special training for all police in schools.
So, can you explain what is and isn't required under state law for police working in schools?
So it's a little confusing, but right now the law requires anyone who claims to be a school resource officer to receive 40 hours of basic SRO training from the National Association of School Resource Officers, also known by the acronym NASRO, or another approved program. But police are allowed to work inside schools without any special training, so long as they don't call themselves SROs.
So that basic 40-hour SRO training, what does that cover?
So the NASRO 40-hour training covers a lot, including development of the teen brain, students with disabilities, adverse childhood experiences and how trauma can affect brain development and behavior in children, how to spot the signs of sex trafficking, how to identify racial biases and develop relationships with students from diverse and marginalized backgrounds, as well as how to be an informal counselor or mentor to students, among other things.
So, do we know how many police in Indiana schools have or have not received that training?
We don't. And that's because the state doesn't track it. So the number is unknown. We also don't know the total number of police in Indiana schools. State lawmakers passed legislation last year that requires schools to report the number of police in their buildings to the Department of Homeland Security on an annual basis. But that information is confidential by law for quote unquote safety reasons.
But there is interest in changing this law. Can you tell me who those people are and why?
Yeah, Chase Lyday, he's the head of the Indiana School Resource Officers Association, and he told me he's been trying for years to get lawmakers to require training for all police in schools, but so far he's been unsuccessful. Lyday and other SRO training advocates say it's unreasonable to expect police who have been trained to patrol streets to be able to function well within a school setting without any specialized training. So the head of NASRO, who also happens to work in Carmel Clay Schools, told me that you never question why a detective or a SWAT team officer needs specialized training. And it's the same for police working in schools. They need this special training. And so these SROs worry that without this training, that arrests will increase, as well as physical altercations between police and students. And we know from data that we received from the Indiana Department of Education that arrests of Indiana students actually increased between 2016 and 2019. They fell slightly in the 2020 school year during the pandemic, but not by that much. We also know from the data that Black students were arrested at more than twice the rate of white students between 2016 and 2020.
So how likely is it that this training will be required for all police in schools? I mean, is there any chance that that'll happen?
So I've talked to a couple lawmakers who do support this kind of training mandate, but they say the resistance to it from their colleagues in the General Assembly comes from a worry that requiring 40 hours of training for all police in schools would lead to a drop in the number of officers in schools. So that's where we are on the legislative front. But I should also mention that the Indiana Department of Education has recently partnered with NASRO to offer this training to up to 180 police officers over the next 2 years. A spokesperson for the IDOE says they're targeting regions of the state that lack trained SROs, but they're still trying to figure out where those areas are.
That was Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jenny Lindsay speaking with education reporter Lee Gaines about why some police want the state to mandate special training for officers who work inside schools. To read more about training for police in schools, go to www.lakeshorepublicradio.org.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Here's regionally speaking host Chris Nolte with a conversation with Indiana University Northwest economics professor Micah Pollack.
Indiana University Northwest associate professor of economics Micah Pollack, of course, has a very, very popular Twitter page as he takes a very constant look at how the coronavirus is affecting Northwest Indiana, mainly from the economic viewpoint, but a lot of it I'm sure else gets in as well. And he is with us to talk about the fact that that I guess your subject matter that you've followed through on has picked up some attention on a much wider basis than just Northwest Indiana. It's shown up on a podcast, I understand. Will you tell us first about this podcast series that you're involved with IU?
Thanks for having me, Chris. Mm-hmm. Sure. So, you know, not surprisingly, it's not just Northwest Indiana that's interested in COVID-19 and the trends and the latest numbers. It's, you know, something that the state and nationally, even internationally, has become an important topic, obviously, in the last year and a half or so. And, you know, I've been lucky enough to have some of my analysis talked about, you know, both on an IU podcast and as well as kind of on some national and international media as well.
I know that the university likes to bring in experts from campus, faculty members and researchers and the like on a number of topics. And certainly I'm sure that they have had a number of podcasts that have brought in other experts from the School of Medicine and the like from IU into this topic in particular. What in particular did they want to seek out from you as a part of your research and certainly looking latest look into the Delta variant?
Yeah, so there's always an economic component to, you know, when you talk about COVID-19 because, you know, it is triggering an economic crisis worldwide. And so, you know, with the rise of Delta, there's questions, will we go back into lockdown? What are going to be the long-term economic effects? And, you know, how will the nation and its economy deal in response to this new variant?
When you took a look at the information, you get a chance to look at all the figures, and even though we know we're not getting as much from the State Department of Health anymore than we have, at least in the past, at least the last few months anyway, What indications have you gotten lately from them? Certainly more focusing on the Delta variant that is going to have the impact that you know is going to come about to the local economy as well as maybe even the state or the regional economy.
Yeah, so this current rise of the Delta cases is a little different than the beginning of the pandemic when we were also very much concerned about how it might impact the economy, because today we have the tools to deal with COVID-19. We have the vaccines. We have research on what works and what doesn't work. And so in a sense, the question is, how much are we going to take advantage of those tools, and how much are we just going to let what happened last spring happen again? I think that's kind of the heart of the issue, and it kind of ties into all this other discussion over should vaccines be mandated, should wearing face masks be mandated, what should happen with schools. And so it kind of all blends back together. Mm-hmm. And it comes down to how willing are we to try to just simply defeat this virus and end the pandemic today?
I know there has been concern, and there's still concern even from some. Unfortunately, those who have not gotten vaccinated, they have the reasons why they have not. And some of them have come about because of what's been in the news lately about the political charged nature of the virus and trying to deal with it. But what are you thinking that people should know based on what you've learned about, for example, the Pfizer and the Moderna vaccines? Are they still very effective, and will they be able to deal better with the Delta variant than what they have, at least with the primary variant so far, or the primary virus so far?
Yeah, so the Delta variant is a new challenge. Generates generally 1,000 times the viral load in your body compared to the original virus, which ends up making about twice as infectious. As far as we know, it's probably about the same level of deadliness as the original strain, although it might be a little bit more deadly specifically for older ages. But we're talking about this variant as being as infectious as chickenpox. Mm-hmm. And as this variant has risen, it's kind of forced out all the other previous variants in the original strain. Almost all the cases in Indiana of COVID-19 in the last month have been the Delta variant. So it's not like we're waiting around for it to get here. It's here. And if you or someone you know catches COVID, it's 99% chance roughly that you have caught the Delta variant. Mm-hmm. And the vaccines that we developed for the original strain continue to be effective. So close to 95% or more effective at eliminating your risk of serious illness, so being hospitalized or dying. The difference, and I think some of the controversy comes in because, vaccines don't mean you cannot catch the virus, right? You're out there, you get sneezed on, you get exposed, and when you get exposed to that virus, your body mounts a defense, and the vaccines are the tools that they use to mount the defense. And because the Delta variant has such a higher viral load, it takes you a little bit longer to, fight off the virus. And in that time, you might have symptoms. You could be contagious. And so that's the big difference for the Delta variant. So even though the vaccines will keep you out of the hospital, keep you from dying, they won't block the contagiousness as much as they would on an earlier strain, simply because this is just a much nastier variant. And so if you get vaccinated, that's still the best thing you can do, and it's incredibly effective at preventing you from having a serious illness from the virus. But you should also be aware that it doesn't mean you can never get infected and you can never spread the virus.
It just, I guess, primarily means that the variant could cause somebody to get sick, but if they've been vaccinated, at least the likelihood of a very serious illness or worse is not quite as likely to happen, I suppose.
Yes, exactly. So that, if you're infected and you're vaccinated, it's a huge reduction in risk. Since the beginning of the year, 98.5%, so 98.5% of all hospitalizations have been people that were unvaccinated, and 98% of deaths have been among people that are unvaccinated. So there's always going to be a few exceptions here and there if you have a weak immune system or you're immunocompromised or something like that. But getting vaccinated is just an incredible tool at essentially limiting your risk of a severe illness.
Now, since your primary field of study, of course, is economics, and you look very closely into the Northwest and the regional economies here, dealing with your regular matters, but when it comes to dealing with the virus, that certainly has a major impact, as we know, financially, economically in the region. Are you seeing that there is concern, at least around the region, that the Delta variant may cause some more economic problems for us here?
It's possible. A lot of the challenges we faced with the original virus, when it began over a year ago, might rear their heads again. You may have businesses that are forced to, close temporarily while, their workers are quarantined. But the big difference is that we have in our hands the tools to prevent that from happening. And I understand there's a lot of controversy over requiring vaccines, but let me just point out that if you are a business and you have your employees vaccinated, the pandemic is essentially over for you because you don't have to worry about workers, you know, needing to be quarantined or, you know, closing your business because workers are sick, and it just essentially makes the pandemic go away. So we have these wonderful tools that we just need to use, and, you know, we can go back to the business as normal pre-pandemic.
Well, I guess it's just a matter then, too, just doing the common sense things of keeping things clean so that you kind of keep the virus at least at bay and make sure that people are protected by getting their vaccinations, just in general, so that if you have a business, you yourself as well as your employees will be safe and hopefully stay healthy that way too.
Absolutely. And if, you know, requiring a vaccine is just a little too much for you, at least consider requiring face masks, which, you know, at worst are a minor inconvenience and have the potential to reduce the spread as well.
Indiana University Northwest Professor of Economics Micah Pollack has been looking into this and still does for his Twitter feed, and he has had an opportunity to talk on a recent IU podcast about the Delta variant. And thank you very much, Micah, for being with us, and we hope to hear back from you soon with more great news and great innovation that will come about here as far as looking into public health is concerned. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you for having me, Chris.
Regionally Speaking with host Chris Nolte can be heard each Monday through Thursday at noon on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM and streaming online at lakeshorepublicradio.org, where you can also find podcasts of the show when you click on the program link.
For the latest in local news and information, tune in Monday at 6 a.m. for Morning Edition with local host Chris Nolte. Lakeshore Update is supported by the listeners and members of Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM. Podcasts for Lakeshore Update are posted each Friday on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org, as well as on NPR One. Make sure you search for WLPR and select us as your home station. Music for Lakeshore Update was written and produced by bensound.com. For Lakeshore Update, I'm Dee Dotson.